This is Out of Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 392 for September 22nd of 2017, traversing Chevy's crossover lineup. Watch Out of Line After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube.
Autoline After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems. And by Hyundai, better drives us.
Well, welcome everybody to Autoline After Hours. Man, we've been off the air for a couple of weeks, and I cannot wait to get going again. My co-host, Gary Vasilash, is off somewhere. He's not here today. He'll be back for the next show. But flying wingman for me today is Stephanie Brindley from IHS Market, and it's great to have you on the show.
Thanks,
again.
Yes, thank you.
We got Henry Payne, the car critic for the Detroit News. And Henry, always good to have you here.
Oh, nice of you to have me.
Especially when we're talking about cars.
Yeah, I love cars.
But our special guest is Rick Spina. He's the executive chief engineer for crossovers at General Motors. And you brought a brand new Chevrolet Traverse into the studio with you. So.
Yep. It was a great drive, right?
Yeah.
Just getting through the doors was a little entertaining.
It's a little tight for some of the bigger vehicles.
Right.
But so what all crossovers do you work on besides the one here?
I'm fortunate enough I work on the Chevy Traverse, the new Buick Enclave, Cadillac XT5, GMC Terrain, Chevy Equinox, and the Buick Envision. Other than that, not
much. Probably another Cadillac movement that you can't talk about.
Yeah. At General Motors, we do not discuss future portfolio.
There you go.
That's right.
All of these in the last 2 years.
Yeah, absolutely. All these in the last 2 years. So it's been a busy couple of years for my team.
Yeah.
And
your family still know you?
Rewarding.
Yep. Still know the names of your daughters?
I do still know the name of both my girls. Yep. Yep, absolutely.
They still know your phone number.
They do still know my phone number. Yeah, we were just joking, right? I just got a text from one of them on a car question. Mm-hmm. So that works fine. But in fairness, I'm fortunate, right? As the executive guy, I don't have to do nearly as much traveling as a lot of my team does. So they're the ones that have really been slogging in the trenches. But, you know, you work in this business, the reward is basically the product. Right. Most of us choose to be here because we love the product. Right. So that's kind of the fulfillment of it. Launching new stuff is the best.
And boy, when you rattle off all those model names, what a perfect time. I mean, with the market just going hog crazy over crossovers.
Yeah, it's, you know, when you're a forecaster or a planner, you know, you get it right sometimes. and it doesn't feel like that. And, you know, as the engineering guy, we love to complain that the forecasts aren't perfect. But in this case, yeah, we're pretty fortunate. We're spotting the trends of what people like. You know, we're in a fashion business, right? And not just the fashion of what it looks like, but how it behaves and how it's mm-hmm. configured. And you got to spot the trends and move with them. So we're fortunate that way.
So what'd you spot on this new Traverse? I mean, what do you think really sets this apart from the previous one?
Thanks. There's a lot of things, but some real fundamental pieces of it, right? One of the things we talk about and the media has noticed and many people have noticed is the appearance, right? There's this interesting thing that started in the United States and it's really moving around the world. It's that can you get the practicality and functionality of the old minivan for families, but not the connotations, not the appearance that goes with the minivan, right? So with this Traverse, frankly, we've done, I think, a great job of making the thing appear a little more truck-like, a little more fashion-forward, yet it's still really practical for taking around, you know, you and the kids and your family needs. So that's the first piece of it, what the thing looks like. Second of all, function-wise, right, in this kind of a space, it's primarily a family vehicle. Everyone wants to be happy. You want to be comfortable, right? So we tried to make sure we had enough space, somewhere for everyone to plug their mobile device in, mm-hmm. right, and be connected, and somewhere to put their stuff, right? I joke about a French fry holder for everybody, right? Someone's got a spot. I know it sounds funny, but, you know, basics in every segment. You get the basics right, and then you move to the trick place. Right. So in this segment, it's am I efficient? Do I handle well? Am I nice to drive in? And do I have a spot for all my folks? Then I move into the trick place.
Rick, I'm intrigued by it. I mean, you handle so much product in this space. Mm-hmm. Shares platforms, shares drivetrains, electronics. How do you as an engineer differentiate a Chevy, a GMC? I mean, there's really nothing on this car that doesn't exist on Cadillacs and GMCs. How do you guys approach differentiating these brands now?
So it's one of the fun pieces of doing the strategy part of the job, the differentiation. If I'm sitting there having a business discussion, then sharing a lot is really important from a business perspective, right? Because it's just less effort and therefore less cost to get it in. If I'm sitting here talking to primarily a car lover, they like to hear us talk about things being very, very different, right? So, Henry, your question is terrific. The easiest thing to talk about is what's different first. And generally what's different is the things you see, okay? The things you look at, the things you see, the style, that fashion piece of it. Next then comes how it behaves with inputs, steering inputs, suspension inputs, braking inputs, how it behaves. Do you choose, and generally their choices, do I choose to make a Cadillac drive in a more sporty feel, for example, more aggressive kind of way? Aggressive is not the right word for Cadillac, but if you understand, right, more driver-oriented than, say, I might choose to do on a Chevy that's a little more family-oriented. And we make those choices. A lot of times with the same basic hardware, you can make the vehicle feel and behave differently. Easy one to think about is shock absorbers, spring rates, those kinds of things. We can work those back and forth to every hot rodder knows right from the beginning you can play with that on a ride and handling, ride versus handling, right? So you can actually take that right on through the chain of things like, what's a good example? On your instrument cluster, right? How do you choose the cluster to present itself as a very sporty feel or more of a practical feel? You know, some folks are intimidated by too much information. So we try and make those trade-offs brand to brand.
Well, and I guess the brand, too, kind of determines what you do with the platform. I mean, the GMC Acadia is also a beautiful new midsize SUV like this, but you guys chose to downsize that a little bit. Doesn't have a big – does it still have a third row?
Yeah.
Yeah, it still has a third row. But this thing, the Chevy, the family vehicle, has the biggest third row in the class. But the Acadia is more – you kind of downsize that. The GMC is just a different customer.
Right. The GMC is a different customer. And recall that in the United States, in most cases, Buicks and GMCs are in the same showroom. Right, so we have some more choices there. The Acadia versus the Traverse, in this case, being a little smaller, it is more head-to-head size-wise with some of the important competitors, especially in the more urban parts of the country, that parking space, garage space, those kinds of things may be a more important piece of this than having absolute maximum space like we try to do with the Chevy.
So we differentiate that away. This Traverse is large.
It is large. Absolutely. It's a wee bit bigger than the old one.
Yeah, and the old one was still pretty big. It is one of the largest ones in the segment, and certainly you get the utility out of that.
We think so. I mean, we have more space than pretty much everybody else in the segment. So if you're making that choice, if in Michigan I go up north, other parts of the country go down the shore, or I go to the beach, right? If I take vacations, that space is important. But, yeah, we made that active choice. I think it's working out pretty well for us. We'll see.
Hey, we've got a phone call that's come in from one of our listeners, our viewers. Carmen, let's bring in that first phone call.
Hi, this is Rick from Laguna Niguel, California, and I have a question for Rick Spina. I like the rear window wiper design feature of the Yukon and Tahoe, which has it located beneath the rear spoiler. This also has the benefit of protecting the wiper blade from UV rays when not in use. Why doesn't the entire line of GM SUVs adopt this as a signature design feature? Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for that call.
Well, you've got me stumped.
Good question.
Great question. We do pay attention to where we place it. Now, the advantages you mentioned, I hadn't really thought about before. I'm sure the guys that work on wipers as their expert piece of what they do for a living, they could tell me the answers. I do know that in many cases we prefer it on the top. Actually, for our own styling reasons, we like to try and hide it up top as much as we can, tuck it up under that spoiler so it doesn't look as cluttered. But you bring up an interesting point. I've got to learn more. I don't have a great answer beyond that one.
Good. We love honest guests.
One of the things I find interesting with this Traverse is the high country trim level, which I believe is what we have here, right?
That is a high country here,
It is a high country here. So we have now a trim level above the Premier or Premium, the top from before. You're looking to maybe capture some of the magic that GMC has been able to accomplish with Denali?
So whether it's Acadia, Denali, or whether it's some of those other guys that you know, make expensive up-level trims, I'd rather eat my own young than have somebody else eat it for me. So in this case, we really don't feel it will take from the GMC. There aren't there isn't as much cross-shopping between GMC and Chevrolet as one might think. When we go do the statistics, we're pretty careful at watching ourselves. If I remember correctly, it's less than 15% cross-shopping between the two.
That's amazing.
It is shocking. There's two other pieces of this that I kind of find. First of all, there is a lot of dealership loyalty built out there over time. And so generally, as people progress, if they get a little more affluent or the kids get a little bigger, as they start to move up, a lot of times they will start with that dealer they've already worked with. Mm-hmm. And if they have the affluence, I'd hate for them to leave the Chevy dealer on the way to the GMC store and walk past one of those other guys in the middle.
I find it interesting watching, of course, across the industry we're seeing this. Every brand, every vehicle has got more and more and more going on in the interior. And so where is that upper limit for consumers? Because if I remember right, there's a several thousand dollar difference now between the top end of this vehicle, previous generation and this generation, more so than before. I agree with you. I don't think that it's going to take that much from Denali, but it'll be interesting to see Chevy work with this brand. As Chevy is a much more mainstream and a much higher volume brand than GMC is, and having known GMC, Denali just was a beautiful organic growth. I mean, it just has been perfectly brilliant, and now you're trying to figure out how to grow it. But Chevrolet has a different market to work with and a different set of customers, and it'll be interesting to see how High Country evolves over time. And if we have any sort of, you know, economic issues, or if we run into interest rates coming up pretty high, I can see some of things like that might impact how High Country ends up doing, where people want to stay with the brand. There is a lot of range in that Traverse lineup, so you can get a nicely contented car at a much lower price than High Country. So you still can keep that person. But it'll be interesting to see how those...
I couldn't have said any better, so I won't.
Hey, we got another question here. Mike from San Francisco wants to know, any chance that the Traverse will get a hybrid module from Cadillac's XT5 to increase mileage over 30 miles per gallon?
There's always a chance. I would just tell you right now, my team's not working on that right now. Could it be done? Absolutely. We really keep a careful eye on what people want. Mm-hmm. Right. Our job is kind of make people happy. So if we determine that we can make enough people happy doing exactly that, and I can afford to, I will.
As long as I'm asking about powertrain, Keith Dunlap wrote in to say, any chance of a diesel in the Traverse like the Colorado diesel?
Kind of the same answer. There's always a chance. And I'll leave it at that.
Okay. Yeah.
Along those lines.
I'm going to jump one back. Yeah. Recall that, you know, my same team, or a different part of my team, that we have done the diesel and Equinox.
Yeah.
And that's now rolling out to the dealers. It's there. We're selling it. So if that's very successful, that's good news for us doing more diesels.
Gotcha. Yeah.
Well, continue along that alternative line, alternative drivetrain line. You've had announcements. We had an announcement from Jaguar today. We've had an announcement from Volvo. You not only have to keep the customers happy, you have to keep regulators happy. And these two brands now say they're going to electrify everything in their lineup. We've kind of learned that means they're going to put in 48-volt batteries, which not only helps them with fuel economy, but also helps them with all this electronics that are coming into cars. I mean, is that an easy thing for you engineers to do cost-wise?
It's an easy thing to do technically. Mm-hmm. It's not an easy thing to do cost-wise. Mm-hmm. The toughest aspect of the technical piece, once you figure out where I can place the motor, where I can place the battery, those kinds of things, the other that I'm aware of biggest challenge is integrating everything so the electric support assists with the traditional IE-type engine without making funny noises and bumps and giggles and jerks and things, right?
But those are technical.
Those are technical. Right? Yeah. I'm that kind of guy.
Yeah.
But the money piece is difficult for sure. To meet the regulations, we're very regularly, like by the hour, continue trying to evaluate what's the best bang for the buck in terms of lowering the carbon footprint for less dollars. Right? If we spend less dollars, we charge less dollars. Right? So it's not just about making money. It's just about can I keep everything moving. So a hybrid, heavy hybrid, mild hybrid, plug-in hybrid, they're all part of this equation. Every one of those, the more greenhouse gas we get today, generally the more it costs. So that's the challenge. So how can we keep on that that knife edge of staying really, really affordable but also absolutely meeting the regulation and making folks happy? And some folks are a lot more happy by a really green vehicle than some others.
Mm-hmm. Well, and this is an interesting subject because you're right. We've had several automakers talk about how they're going to electrify their full range, but IHS Markit's production for powertrains is not even remotely surprised by this. We sort of saw that electrification is going to increasingly be an issue across the industry and for all automakers. I don't think we were saying, you know, which automaker is going to make that bold statement of that. So that certainly is something that I think is just something the industry is having to work with. And it's a tool in the toolbox that you need.
But it's real cost. So, I mean,
it's real cost. And you're seeing the brands that are claiming this right now are generally luxury brands that can charge a higher price and have a little bit more leeway to absorb that. For somebody like GM, you need to deploy it in the right circumstances for the right industry or for the right markets and for the right cars. But one thing on the Traverse that GM is doing really, really well right now is stop-start, which in some definitions can be considered electrification, right?
Yes.
And it's brilliant. I keep getting surprised. I've been in several different iterations of GM products over the last 6 or 8 months. It's such a good system, and I'm actually really surprised when I get into other systems that are not. They're just still a little jerky, and you've done a really terrific job with coming up with a very smooth system for something that those of us in the industry understand what's happening, but a general consumer is like, why is my car turning off?
Yeah.
It's disturbing.
Wait, hold these thoughts, because we got to take a quick break right now. We'll pick up the conversation when we come back. But first, a shout out to our friends at Bridgestone. Okay, we're back, and we were going to pick up the conversation again on stop-start.
Yeah.
Rick Spina, you got it.
I appreciate you noting that how smooth the stop-start is. When we took on stop-start, we decided it was a pretty nice fuel economy gain versus the takeaways, right? It definitely takes some getting used to for folks. What we're seeing is that people that buy it, even some folks that were not sure about it, they adapt pretty quickly. But I would tell you that we had a lot of debate inside the company with whether to allow the person to defeat it. Mm-hmm. And
i.e. you have a switch, to turn it off.
Thanks. Yeah. To turn it off, as many of the first users of this did. We've chosen not to do that, and almost all the folks that test the vehicle write about it. But I would tell you that I would give some folks, not me, I give some other folks within the company credit. The feeling was, if we don't allow a button to happen, we will force ourselves to a much more integrated solution that has less disruption to the customer. And I think that strategy has been very successful in terms of the notice that we're kind of probably leading the other guys in terms of making this as seamless as possible.
Yeah.
For
I
sure,
think
it's super mild electrification, but...
Yeah, I think it'll be interesting brand by brand. I mean, I you saw back in the 70s with the automatic seat belts, and it annoyed a lot of customers. That was a regulatory thing. This is a regulatory thing. It'll be interesting to see over time how every brand deals with it. Because I inevitably get in cars, even Chevys, which are generally very smooth, as you note, and it throws people off. They think their car's stalling.
But, you know, people hated ABS when it first came out. Now, part of that was the pulsation in the brake pedal, which is largely
eliminated. But they don't use that all the time.
Right. But, I mean, part of it is the industry just getting better at doing things, and part of it is the public just getting used to it.
It's both, certainly. I mean, the systems will get better and better. ABS is a much smoother system than it used to be as well. And you have to make it strong enough and a smooth enough system that consumers will accept it. At some point, you have to find that connection there in order to retain your customers.
Right.
And I think sometimes we...
Or you don't. You find another solution.
Or you find
He's an engineer, for God's sake. I mean, you can do anything, right?
That's true.
Enough time and money.
Yeah. You know, and it's interesting, too, sometimes how, people that are just going out and buying cars, and they buy their car and they don't think about it for the next 5 years, they aren't at paying attention to things as much as others. I had somebody in the Traverse with me on the launch who was sitting in the passenger seat, and as I was driving, asked me what the light was, why a light kept flashing in my mirror, in the side view mirror. She just hadn't seen it yet, and so I explained that's blind spot detection, and she just wasn't sure what it was or even that it really had existed. And I think the last car she bought was a 14 or a 15. So just at the point where she had done that research was not quite as full on.
Yep.
But the point is we still have a lot of consumers out there that aren't that haven't caught up with blind spot or start stop or some of these other features that are there. And so we've got a bit of lag, too.
Yeah.
Well, let me ask you on the start stop, because you have so much electronics coming into cars now. And you guys have been innovators in Wi-Fi in cars and Apple in the smartphone apps. Your competitors like Toyota and Honda are standardizing the safety assist systems. They think that's really important to standardize. You guys have standardized the Wi-Fi and a lot of the interior electronics. I mean, where do you see that going, Rick? I mean, what does the customer demand?
The customer demands progress. And this sounds like a wise answer, but right, you mentioned ABS, right? We can go back to inflatable restraints, airbags, right? It seems like, at least as long as I've been working in the business, there's always a controversy about whatever the new thing coming out is, and eventually it becomes the norm. Mm-hmm. Okay, my sense is these safety technologies, they're going to become the norm. It's just a matter of when and how and who drives which ones first. So far, what we've seen with the research we've done with the folks is, that, like Traverse, for example, we've got a lot of these technologies deployed in a up and down strategy, right? You go up higher, you pay more, you get more. There's been some question about that. But everything we ask the customers about is the ones we've got down lower in the price points are exactly the ones they're asking for. Stephanie, you were kind enough to point out the blind spot one. That's one of the ones that people are now becoming addicted to quickly because they're beginning to experience. They can't experience it. They can't imagine having an SUV without it. Those are the ones they're used to first. Mm-hmm. Some of the others that are a little more cutting edge, they haven't yet said, oh, that's the one I want. That's the one I need. Now, most people don't admit that they'll text and drive, right? Some of the technologies, if you said, yeah, I'm going to text and drive, you might pick a different technology to pick, right, to choose, right? But so far, we're not there. I think, anyway, long answer, I think we're going to move that all these things we're talking about, they will be the norm. It's just a matter of how many more years.
So, again, it's not really a budget issue. You're able, in volumes like this, you're able to get your costs down where you can offer all this stuff.
The way I'd say it is everyone's got the same cost structure, very similar cost structure in the industry. We're all fighting over pennies, not tens of dollars at a time. So then it just becomes, who is our customer? What are they willing to pay for? Mm-hmm. Right? And where are the priorities there?
And would I be correct in thinking that's something that you can adjust model year to model year and throughout the even sort of some to some yes. degree mid-flight? It's pricing and it's packaging. And,
correct.
And once you've already engineered it into the system, you can move these pieces around as it works out over the product's life cycle.
The way we talk about inside the company is the vehicle enabled. Mm-hmm. These kinds of things. So, yes, that's exactly it. We do feel we can respond as necessary to some of the customer requests.
Here's a viewer wrote in to say, I wish the Traverse had an off-road version. I could only dream of owning a 2017 Chevrolet Traverse with a lift and off-road lift kit and off-road tires.
That's actually not an unusual kind of comment.
Go buy a ZR2 is the answer.
Exactly.
Well,
yeah,
I was
right.
thinking Tahoe would.
But how do you actually? He leads to a good thing. How do you decide how many trim lines can you come out with? And it gets to what you were talking about earlier, Stephanie. I understand if you can get a higher price, take the money while you can.
Yeah.
But you don't want to have too many trim lines out there.
No, right. When you get too many, it's just I run out of engineers, right? I run out of engineers. I mean, they're working on one thing instead of something else. Mm-hmm. But I'm getting you an answer that maybe not as intuitive. A few years back, we had a group of guys within GM that started to talk about scar mass. Scar mass, not a term you're going to hear every day. And what they meant was, if I set up a vehicle that can, in this case, was handle a very, very large engine, as well as a fuel efficiency engine, I'll probably engineer it such that the large engine drives most of the weight and most of the mass in the car, most of the weight, and most of the space. Okay. Once I do that, my small engine vehicle is now penalized because it's carrying around this extra mass, in this case, scar mass. If I try and do an off-road version of the car, trust me, we've got a lot of folks inside the company would love to do that. But if I go try and do an off-road version of the car, just like suspension travel, I'd have to have a bunch of extra structure in the bottom of the car that none of the rest of the customers would need, hence mass, hence fuel economy, and probably not as good ride.
Cost.
Cost. So it's all of those things. But in the end, sometimes we get a better vehicle by focusing on exactly what it wants to be and for whom. Mm-hmm. You know, I can kind of do anything. I can't do everything.
Yeah.
Speaking of the scar mass, I mean, the two big technical developments with this car is that it's lost 360 pounds, which is a big number from the previous generation. And I think it's the first SUV, mid SUV with a 9-speed mm-hmm. transmission in it. I mean, those are big, both big technical challenges. I mean, do you see that continuing? Or are we going to continue to see SUVs getting 300 pounds lighter and gaining 12, 15 speed? I mean, the transmission in this thing is really nice. I mean, I got a Lexus LC500 that I'm testing right now, a sports car, and this tranny is better than the 10-speed in the Lexus. I mean, these are really, really impressive technical achievements. I mean, is that going to continue?
You asked earlier about the regulatory environment and greenhouse gas, et cetera. We have to keep getting more and more efficient with whatever it is. What we're finding is taking the mass out so far is a really efficient way, inexpensive way. Mm.
Design it out, right?
Design it out from the beginning.
I.e., better cross-sections,
correct.
More adhesives, that
right.
sort of thing. Not necessarily lighter weight materials, although you're going to go that route, too.
All the above.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
It's really all the above, and it comes down to engineers are practical, right? What's the most efficient way to get the job done? So to your point, you'll see that continue. Now, 9 speeds, 10 speeds, 14 speeds, 8, at some point is a law of diminishing return on that from actually getting more efficiency, but you'll see it keep moving. I don't think it's going to stop. Again, it's going to probably be a fairly practical approach to what's the least expensive way to give the customer the fuel economy they need or meet the requirements, except, as you pointed out, Stephanie, on the very luxe end of the market, where I've got much more price to work with, is there a particular passion from the customer about, I would prefer to pay for a super advanced powertrain
right.
to get my regulation met, or I would prefer to pay for carbon fiber underbody, right? Mm.
Okay, we got another question here. Marcello De Facto says, what's the fuel economy on the new Traverse?
Let's see. It's 27 highway on the front-wheel drive and 23 combined with I'm forgetting now the city number, but it's about 27 highway is the good one on the V6. All right, so there is a 2-liter turbo, 4-cylinder that we're about to come out with that will be a snitch better with a very different power characteristic, a more aggressive mid-range torque, which is fun to drive. But 27 on a car this big, we're really proud of, really, really proud of.
And it's amazing that you could put, even I know it's a turbo, and I know how much better turbo engines are today, but a 4-cylinder in a vehicle this size,
yeah.
it's really saying something.
Yeah, it is. It's something, especially looking around here, we all grew up in the United States, right? We're used to displacement as king, right?
Mm-hmm.
But, if we were in Europe, we wouldn't be so surprised, right? So it's just, how do I make the power? How many holes and what do I do with them?
Rick, we're in the midst of this transformation in the U.S. market from sedans to SUVs. And I think we all look now at SUVs. We're all very practiced in sedans. You had subcompacts, compacts, and the buyer went in and just went up the line. You guys now have full-on SUVs, right? Starting
right.
with a subcompact
Correct.
Trax.
Right.
You seeing the same behavior from customers? They're coming right in at a Trax, or are they still coming in at a sedan and working their way up?
It's all the above. A lot of customers are coming right into Trax.
Mm-hmm.
I joke a little bit. My customer research is going to look at the high school parking lots, right? You go look at the mm-hmm. high school parking lots, then go to the expensive private school, less expensive public school, right? And if the kids are come from families affluent enough to buy something reasonably new, you see what they want. And there's a lot of subcompact SUVs in high school parking lots. That's my advanced form of research. We have better than that, but that's what I'm seeing. This whole idea of command view of the road, an SUV is a really big deal. A lot of younger people feel safer, older people, they'll feel safer being up higher. They express that either from a visibility perspective or less vulnerable to the trucks around them. Mm-hmm. And a lot of parents choose that for their kids too, interestingly. And so it's sometimes it's just that, other times it's practicality. The other piece of your question, as people work through their own lives, we do see they move toward in and out of 3-row cars. In and out of the 3-row SUVs.
Mm-hmm.
They'll get a 3-row SUV when the kids are that age, right? Kids, everybody has to be in a seatbelt. So even if you have 2 kids, they've got a friend, you're moving towards a 3-row vehicle. The question then is, once your kids are out of the house, do you stay with a 3-row? Because I might go out to dinner with more than one other couple, or if I go back to a 2-row. Lots of people then go back to a 2-row and go down a little bit in size.
Mm-hmm. It all just seems more complicated to me, with when we were just driving sedans. Trucks just meant pickups.
Mm-hmm.
You could take a sedan, you could take a mid-size sedan, you could make an SS version of it. You know, you could do all kinds of stuff within that model line. Now you basically have parallel model lines. You have a parallel sedan, an SUV. I just got out of a Jeep Grand Cherokee Trackhawk.
Yeah. I just got out of one, too.
Yeah,
what a monster.
Yeah, 700-horsepower monster is an SUV. I mean, are we going to start seeing pressure from customers to do SS SUVs, or you think they're going to continue to just be the modern station wagon?
No, I think you'll see. I think you'll see the sports presence in the SUV too. Mm-hmm. I think I mentioned before it is a fashion business. Despite the engineering side of me wants to just focus on the technical, you have to pay attention to what's in style, what's in fashion. And if SUVs in fashion, for sure, there's going to be always going to be a wish for more horsepower, better handling, more look at me factor. And my job is to cater to that when I can. If we can make money at it and make people happy both, that's the job.
I think you're going to be busy.
Yeah.
Because I think that it's going that way.
And Trackhawk and some of the Mercedes projects, I mean, obviously we're seeing that already. I mean, if you do have two parallel courses and SUVs, you still have people who want something that looks a little fancier, something that goes a little faster. And then you still want people who want very practical things. So you're still catering to the same basic need.
Yeah.
They're choosing a different shape at the moment, but the needs are still there.
But that's so much capital because those are two different platforms. Now you're getting electric platforms, which is a whole different platform demand. I mean, it seems to me the capital demands in your business are really going up.
They're definitely out there. My sense is every manufacturer is going to have to make a choice. Right? You know, can I continue to put chips on every number on the roulette wheel, or am I have to put fewer chips in some spots? And I suspect one of the fun things about the business is we'll make some slightly different choices, manufacturer to manufacturer, as we make our bets.
Yeah. I think when you look at full size cars, I think that's where you see the biggest risk. If you look at an Impala, people who tend to want to think that they need as much space as the Impala has, and the Impala's a terrific car. There's a more of a tendency to move up to a Traverse in that space. And what we're seeing in sales right now is that seems to be the most vulnerable market right now. Mid-size cars have gotten so large that's come up, and the full-size cars are now quite large. And, you know, if you really feel you need that much space, people tend to just skip it and go straight to an SUV.
That's right. Look, we're going to have to wrap this up right now. Rick Spina, thanks so much for coming on the show.
It's been a pleasure
talking with you.
Enjoy
it. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back. We got a lot of things to talk about going on elsewhere in the industry. But first, a shout out to our friends at Hyundai. Okay, we're back. Well, that's very interesting. You know, boy, he's in the catbird seat because the market is coming to his babies.
That's a good place to be.
Well, and I think the neat thing for GM, at least in their mainstream, is that it's allowing them to recreate Buick. I mean, Buick's become a relevant brand again because they reinvented themselves with SUVs. And you can take GMC, which is a truck brand, and you can make that an SUV brand. I mean, those are for both those brands. This market change is a huge opportunity.
Yeah, it is. And of course, you can keep your trucks because the trucks are still pretty important.
Right,
that's not going away. But it's interesting times for sure.
Oh yeah, no, and about to get scary in another decade or so. Mm. But let's talk about some of what's been going on. Either of you follow what went on at the Frankfurt show last week?
Here and there, I did not get to attend this year. So
yeah, I was
but
there.
We're watching.
Anything that came out of the show that stood out for you?
Still a lot of conversations about electrics, and at this point, EVs. It's like the Europeans figured it out. that EVs might be a thing. And they're being pushed hard.
I got a different take on that. They're talking so much EV stuff because they want to take everyone's mind off diesel. I think they're all jumping into Formula E for this very reason. You know, the German elections are, what, mm-hmm. next month, I think, mm-hmm. in a matter of weeks, certainly. And, you know, the German auto industry has become a political issue in these elections, you know, and you have Angela Merkel scolding the industry, which, right. you know, who would have ever thought something like that would happen? So all they want to talk about is electric, because they are going to be as green can be to try to get this diesel issue to go away.
Well, okay, if you think about what's going on with autonomous and the projects and the concepts that they were showing, too, and you're looking at it, the general assumption seems to be that the best solution for an autonomous car is to make it electric. I have said here before that I don't think that it's required to be an electric
Correct.
Car, but
Correct.
That does seem to be what the industry is sort of saying, and this is the way it's going to go. Mm-hmm. So you've got electrification and connectivity and autonomous kind of coming together at the same time. I think diesel is playing into that, but it's along the side. It's not the primary driver to some of these conversations, because you're still talking 5 and 10 years out for some of the things that they're introducing. I mean, the smart EV that was there, the smart concept that was there without steering wheel and pedals, because it was full autonomous, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of the drive for EV, but I still think as much as consumers can be brought along, I think we're leading them a little bit further, and I think that the electric vehicles that are coming out may be coming out a little ahead of consumers being ready to jump on.
Yeah, I think that's. I think. I mean, the government ought to be examining itself in Europe, because because they're not giving automakers a choice. They're, you know, you got France and Britain forcing them toward a technology. In 20 years, 20 years is not a lot long time. We all thought 20 years ago that hybrids would be a much bigger share of the market today. Right. There's still three.
It's not even 20 years away, Henry. I mean, it's much sooner than that. And I want to get your guys' feedback, too, on this thought of all these countries that are claiming they're going to ban the internal combustion engine.
That's what I'm saying. They're forcing a technology. And they did this 20 years ago with diesel.
Yeah.
20 years ago, Europe forced diesel by taxation, and now they hate diesel. You know, I mean, let the markets and the consumers determine what they like. But politics tends to be a faddish business, and diesel 20 years ago was their choice.
And these statements so far are just statements. So far, the actual laws haven't been changed. The logistics on how do you actually accomplish that. That feat hasn't even begun to be addressed. So at this point, it's still statements. And whether it comes true or not, it does signal the directionality. And China is another issue as well, because China is deciding to push new electric vehicles, new energy vehicles, as they call them, really hard as well. And they're looking at changing the structure of partnerships. Up until now, in order to build a car in China, you had to be a JV. And you can have 2 JVs for internal combustion engines. You can have a third for electric cars. Now they're considering just letting foreign automakers just build electric car plants there.
Yeah.
So
in free trade zones.
In free trade zones, yes. It's
so
it's limited.
Not just anywhere.
It's not
they're
just
still
anywhere.
Contained.
There's still some containment and some restrictions on it. But they know they obviously feel they can't do it by themselves necessarily, with relying on the own market to do that. And so you've got the U.S. kind of leaning in this direction. You've got Europe pushing towards diesels or towards EVs, and you've got China pushing. It's not one market, and it's not one powertrain problem, I don't think. I don't think it's just diesel. I think it's a combination of things just sort of hitting at the same time. And we'll find out in the next 2.5 years when some of these products start rolling out whether the consumers are ready to be led along. They may adapt quicker than we think.
Look at the market.
Nobody's still betting on it.
Yeah, I mean, I think we got a huge consumer problem. I mean, I was just in a Tesla for a couple of days out in Silicon Valley, which is unusual. It's hard to get a Tesla and actually drive it for a couple of days like you would drive another car.
You mean as a car critic, it's hard to get
right,
them?
I mean, every car comes off that line, goes to customers. So usually you get previously I've just got an hour or two in the car. I got the car for 2 days.
Which model?
The Model S. And I took 160 miles off the battery and only went 90 miles, you know, driving 80 miles an hour, driving it like you drive any other gas car, and I came into Mountain View, California, one of the richest zip codes in the country, to charge at 9:30 that night, mm-hmm. went into their supercharger, 12 stalls in the supercharger, everyone was taken, and you had in a waiting line four deep. Now these are people with an average income who are with mm-hmm. incomes in the well into the six figures. They're willing to put up with this, but. Bring the Model 3 into the market, right. which is going to be...
The lines will be longer.
Yeah. I mean, where's the infrastructure to charge these things?
Infrastructure is still an issue.
Yeah, huge issue.
And that's a legitimate concern.
But it's not even infrastructure. I mean, even a supercharger takes an hour to fully recharge. In people's lifestyle, they don't have an hour. They got 5 minutes for gas. Mm-hmm. They don't have an hour to sit there.
Well, and it's one of those things, too, that might be more of a regional play as well. You mentioned driving at 80 miles an hour on the freeway, which would be normal, right?
Yep.
One of the experiences that I've noticed in the EVs that we've had through the office lately is when you do a lot more stop-and-go driving, of course, you can regen a lot more power. When I had Chevrolet Bolt, as a matter of fact, took it on the freeway home, I was using a lot more gas or a lot more electricity than I was when I just took it home, took it to the office via surface streets. Via surface streets, I got from my house to my office, which is about 13 miles, and it showed that I had used like maybe 10 miles of range. And then on the freeway, it showed pretty close, a little bit more. And the difference was just in the driving style, even though...
Getting more regen.
You get some regen on the freeway, but as soon as you then have to accelerate again, you're using it right away.
Right.
So there may be just with EVs, there's lifestyle and environmental situations where it's going to fit better
right.
in certain lifestyles than it is others.
Yeah.
And
which sounds like a niche product.
It's a niche product.
It sounds like a muscle car. It sounds like a minivan. It doesn't sound like a mass market vehicle.
Yeah, and people do have to learn how to drive it differently and learn what its conditions are. You know how to read a fuel tank, a fuel
right.
gauge on a gas can. You understand that's something you've been working with your whole driving life. If you buy an EV, you have to rethink how your energy depletes and how it gets used. That doesn't mean that it's a bad solution, but it does mean that consumers have to learn something new and something different. Some of that learning can be fun.
Mm-hmm.
Can be kind of fun. Like, oh, wait, what can I do to get
that's part of the fun of driving of an
this.
Electric car is, how much can I squeeze out of
what
this
What can I
thing?
Do
oh, yeah.
with this?
Right.
But in doing so, you learn what the limitations and challenges of the system are.
Well, the other thing, Johann Denischen had an interesting interview.
Had a Cadillac.
Cadillac's CEO had an interesting interview with Car and Driver this week, and one of the questions was, why aren't you doing a Tesla fighter? And Denischen's answer was, well, once you tell me how Tesla's business model works, I'll tell you how we'll make money on an electric car. I mean, that's the other. The legislature of California is basically considering a bailout bill right now for Tesla because they can't figure out how to make money.
I thought that bill got nixed.
It's still going nowhere. It's still alive, yeah.
Oh, is it really?
It was nixed,
still going.
But it's been resurrected. But, by the standards of the market, by the customer, it's one of the best-selling luxury cars in the market. Average transaction price of $100,000, they can't make money. How do you make money on these things?
It's still a challenge.
Well, Sergio at FCA has said that if electric cars really do catch on, car companies are no longer going to be able to afford to subsidize them. They all lose money on every single one that they make. So he says prices are going to have to go up.
Right.
Even though battery costs are coming down, the price of the car is going to have to go up.
Right.
That's going to drive away sales.
Right.
I mean, it's like anything else. You raise the price and you lose sales.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's like Rick said today. I mean, we're just talking about 48-volt battery. That's a small battery. And that's too expensive for these mainstream manufacturers. I routinely ask mainstream manufacturers, VW and Honda, why aren't you electrifying the Civic or the Golf? And they roll their eyes and say, that's expensive.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and people aren't paying for it right now. It's still, we're leading. The development is leading the consumer on electrics, and consumers are coming along very, very slowly.
Consumers are price sensitive.
They're price sensitive, and again, we're interpreting this too, and largely within our market. And I do think that there's some areas where we'll see different acceptance level. Mm-hmm. The price sensitivity does present a problem pretty much everywhere.
Yeah.
If it costs you too much, then it becomes a luxury to move around, and that limits how many you can sell. I mean, $100,000 for a Tesla, and they're still not making money. That's a serious concern with them.
But the thing that does intrigue me about that cost equation, I just came out of a Uber self-driving Volvo in Pittsburgh, and they're using Volvos XC90s. They switched over from Ford Fusions to Volvo XC90 hybrids. And I said, why'd you do that? Part of it is they're going Uber Black, and they want the branding, but they also say, we like the hybrid. We have so many electronics in this thing with this big computer and the LiDAR on the roof. We like having the hybrid battery. So
they need more juice.
That's right, and this is a trend across the industry. You're getting more and more electronics into cars. Mm-hmm. So maybe there's a natural evolution of batteries into the car, not just for the regulators, but because the manufacturers need to power so much stuff.
No, it is.
TVs and all the stuff.
And look, we're going to have to take another quick break right now and come back and get more back into this conversation. But first, a shout-out to our friends at Lear.
Lear Kinexus offers a parental controls application with geofencing that sends notifications regarding driving behavior and location, including curfew alerts, acceleration alerts, and speed alerts. All delivered to a smartphone application that includes vehicle location, driver notifications, and a report card of driving history, including notifications when predefined geographic boundaries are crossed. For more information, visit Lear.com.
Okay, we're back. And Henry, you were talking about driving or riding in autonomous Volvos that Uber's developing. What'd you think?
It's an interesting experience. I was surprised at how much the engineers intervened on my six-mile drive. I mean, only driverless cars add another driver. So I had two drivers in my driverless car. You have two engineers in the front seat. And they're trying to train a car, a computer, how to drive, and this is what fascinated me, John. Full disclosure: my son also works for NVIDIA and is an engineer working on their chips that will back up the software that all these companies are working on, and they're trying to teach these cars to drive like humans. And so one of the most interesting moments in this drive through downtown Pittsburgh, we never went over 25 miles an hour. They're trying to master the urban environment, the most challenging environment. We're driving down a one-way street at 25 miles an hour. There's a panel truck up in front of us that's being unloaded from the rear. And the driver intervenes and takes over and drives around the panel truck. And I had the same expression on my face that Stephanie does. I said to the engineer, I said, that's autonomy 101. He's just going, the car was going around an object. Why did you take over there? And the driver said, because you and I know there's a human being there. And when we see human beings, we give them more room. The car just sees another object. And so the car is going to come right up to that human being and go around, and it's going to freak the human being out. And we're Uber, and we want to be part of this community, and we want people to accept us, and we don't want to freak people out. But you got to program that kind of minutia into cars so that they act like human beings.
They'll program it.
That's a lot of programming.
That's a lot of programming, but they also...
A lot of AI.
And exactly right. Using artificial intelligence, it can actually start writing some of the code, too. So, you know, everyone likes to point out, all these things aren't ready. Well, no, they're not ready. That's why they're not on the road, except for in a test situation. Right. But give it another 3 to 4 years, and they're going to have this ironed out.
Yeah, and what's interesting from Uber's, I mean, Uber's not a car maker. Uber's a service provider, so what they're interested in is they want their customers to be as comfortable in their cars, whether there's a driver there or not. So the driver experience is a huge piece to what they're doing. They're developing their own software. They're not relying on some OEM automaker to do this for them. They have,
why?
They have 700
yeah.
people.
Why?
But they have 700 people in Pittsburgh trying to figure this out. Yeah.
Waymo's working on it. Delphi's working on it. There's a bunch of companies working on it.
Right.
Why is Uber developing its own?
That's
is it
going to
make
it?
Its own cars or have somebody make cars for it?
No. But clearly the software experience is what they're working on. They're worrying. Somebody else is going to provide the cars for them. Clearly, as Volvo and Ford have mm-hmm. done. But they are so interested in the consumer experience, because self-driving. They got Lyft. They got all these competitors coming in the market.
Volvo's working on its own system without
right.
a leave.
Right.
Right.
So now Uber's going to say, give us those Volvos, but rip out all that auto leave stuff, and we're going to put ours in. I sure would love to have somebody from Uber explain what their strategy is.
Well, their strategy is they as opposed to. It's a great question because that's a big investment by Uber. 700 people. That's just in Pittsburgh. I mean, they're doing self-driving trucks out in Silicon Valley, and that's hundreds of more people. But I think their perspective on transportation is different than the auto manufacturers. I mean, they're so intensely interested in the driver experience. That's what their app is all about. You go use an Uber driver right now. You go grade the guy at the end. They're keenly aware that all you have to do is pick up an app, and they're off to Lyft. Mm-hmm. So I think they're keenly aware in getting the experience right.
And that'll be interesting too, because as everybody is developing there's so many self-driving platforms being developed out there. We were just talking with Rick about how he can create differentiation between one SUV to another. I don't know that you need to develop the whole self-driving platform, but certainly there are going to be things that they can do within the experience that will differentiate a Cadillac from a Chevy, from a BMW, from a Honda, in the way that those cars end up acting and behaving as autonomous vehicles.
Maybe, because I think once you get to a level 5 car, where you don't need a steering wheel or anything like that, are you going to care what, the polar moment of inertia is in a car? Are you going to care how many G's it can generate on a skid pad or how fast it can get through the slalom? I don't think you're going to care at all.
Not any more than people do now. I think that it's the way that you define what you react to will be different. But I do think that there'll end up being differences in the ride and the way that it feels. We were talking with Mazda has talked about they're going to have an autonomous system called Copilot. And at this point, their system, as they've very roughly described it, would be that it's a co-pilot there to take over if something goes wrong.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. You drive until something else goes wrong. And I was thinking, okay, so this is a lot of development, because in order for that car to take over when something goes wrong and move you to a safe place, whatever the system decides that it's a hospital or whether it's off the side of whatever it's supposed to, I don't think they've figured out that entirely. And certainly it would be situational. But if you have to develop it to be able to do that, then you don't need the driver in the first place. You have to be a level 5 on par with everything else. And so it'll be interesting to see if a smaller company like Mazda does continue to develop their own. And if they do, if it's because of this sort of philosophy, automakers need to understand what their core is and what they're really providing in the end. And it may be different for different automakers. These may be called different companies in 25 years. But to simply stay out and not be involved and say, I'm just going to assume I'm going to buy it later, is also a risky proposition.
Right. Yes.
And then you've got Waymo and Uber and companies trying to get into the space a little bit differently.
But I think that's a key point. These auto companies are really good. I mean, just listen to Rick talking about the difference between Chevy, Cadillac, and GMC. These guys are experts at personal branding and understanding mm-hmm. how people view their cars, want their cars, what those cars reflect about themselves. They're experts in personal transportation. The best self-driving car I've been in is the Google car with no steering wheel, just this blob, this mm-hmm. white blob. And I have not been comfortable in any self-driving car except for that car because it felt like public transit. And I wonder if ultimately, to your point, these are just two separate companies. To drive is still personal transportation. It's what all these companies do really well. And now self-driving is a much more anonymous, autonomous thing that's taken care of by some different arm of General Motors.
Well, and even if you're building autonomous cars, even if some of the differentiation isn't necessarily driving, the experience is going to be part of it. You mentioned that you were comfortable in the Google because it felt like public transportation.
Yeah, there's no steering wheel spinning around in front of me.
Right. But you still have people who want a different experience inside. Some people want a more opulent experience. Some people want a more basic experience. And you're still going
to
have...
Well, that's probably more of what they can afford.
Combination. I mean, that is part of it, too, what you can afford. Because what do you buy? If you really can't afford, you buy time and you buy space. Predominantly, that's what people buy. Mm-hmm. Whether it's in a house, whether it's in a car, whether it's in, you know, paying somebody to take care of something that you would have taken care of on your own, you buy space and you buy time. Those probably won't change. But there's still a lot of space in there for these brands to take their personalities of what they are today and express that in an autonomous and a personal mobility vehicle versus an Uber or a Lyft, which is really targeting the public transportation side of things.
Yeah.
So they are these two companies and these two modes of business have completely different objectives.
Yeah,
for sure.
Hey, we've got a few more questions from viewers. We ought to get to them before we end the show. Carmen, let's bring in that other phone call we got from Clem.
This is Clem Zarovsky in Delmont, Pennsylvania. All these new cars seem to have a blunt, straight up and down front grille area. Is that to meet a government regulation about pedestrian impact? Because it doesn't look like it would be very good for aerodynamics. Thank you.
Yeah, no, good question.
Yeah.
Largely has to do with pedestrian protection.
It does.
Those front ends are deliberately designed to throw people up on the hood rather than mow them down with the vehicle. But also, these automakers all love big, bold grills, and a very blunt front end really lends itself to having the room to do that.
It's your first expression of the vehicle, the first thing that you see, and so the more space you have to work with there is better. And designers are really quite strong, even though that I'm looking at the Chevy as we're talking, it has a fairly blunt front end. They've got wind tunnels, and they're pretty good at figuring out how to, even in that shape, find ways to make the maximize the aerodynamics as much as possible, although certainly it's not going to be the same as a low-nose sports car.
That's
yeah.
Right.
No, it is remarkable. I mean, it is remarkable what the engineers can do. John and I were just at the Jaguar event, and they were talking about the new I-Pace, which is their electric car, which is an SUV, rides up higher than their classic gorgeous sedans, and yet they still have a 0.28 drag coefficient out of that thing. Which was remarkable.
Quite good, right? Especially
yeah,
for a crossover.
Yeah, I think they're doing it with I don't know how they're doing it. I mean, it used to be it was shutters on gas cars.
Well, yeah, exactly. You don't have a grill opening. That helps a lot.
Yeah, so
right
helped.
There, you're not forcing a bunch of air into a box on the front of the car.
Yeah, you can do wheel curtains. I mean, there's all kinds of ways they can do this. But if you got sub 0.3 on drag coefficient on a sports car in the old days. That was impressive.
Oh, yeah, no, that was really
impressive. This is an SUV under there.
And about it, too. You know, there's no exhaust pipe running down the floor, so you can have a much flatter floor.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where you really start to pick up some of the other additional benefits is when you can start attacking areas that heretofore have been either very difficult to do or not possible.
And our definition of crossover is...
Yes.
Slipping and sliding.
Right, yeah.
I mean, the picture that was just up there, that's a very, very low vehicle.
Yeah.
It doesn't appear to have quite the same ride height as the Traverse in front of us. And that's part of the when you asked earlier, we talked about SUVs going sporty and that kind of thing. I think one of the things that we're seeing with this definition sliding is that people do want something a little bit different still, and there's still some more space in there, but... Right now, there are things that are being called crossovers that don't fit a traditional definition, for sure.
Yeah.
A couple of other more like comments from viewers here. Ken Croteau, I hope I said that right, says that driverless cars would make a lot more sense in controlled environments like at Disney World than out in the real world. And I think that's absolutely true. I think that's where we're going to see it. You know, geofenced areas, let's put it that way. is going to be the controlled environment. Gary Olofsson says, I'm not sure I believe this. He says the Japanese car companies are predicting 5 years out before sedans are done.
No, I'm not sure that I'm...
He says the Honda Accord is no longer available in a two-door, in the U.S. market.
No, I don't think they're making a coupe outside either.
Okay.
But that's not the same thing as sedans going away.
But it is interesting. I don't know where that factoid came from, because when you talk to the Japanese and Detroit automakers, they're actually very different interpretations of this SUV market. The Honda folks, for example, are still very bullish on sedans. Civic and Accord. I mean, they bring in big volume.
Sell a lot of them.
They bring in a younger buyer. SUVs generally are at a higher price point. I mean, Honda's still pouring money into SUVs. Sure. But then you go down the street here to Chrysler, which is practically out of sedans entirely. There's no new Chrysler sedans coming out. Go down.
The 300 will be replaced.
Yeah,
but that's it.
Yeah, but that's hardly an entry level car. They think that they're going to get their entry level buyers coming in at SUVs. The Japanese are a very different mind.
I'm not really down with this. With saying the sedans are going to be completely going away. I do. Obviously, they're shrinking, and you'll have a little bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy because you're going to have some cars go away. Some segments are going to have a harder time. I mentioned full-size sedans earlier. That's the 300. That's the Impala.
Yeah.
When you've got a sedan that large, it's difficult to justify that over a Traverse or a comparable SUV. But the midsize, there's still space in there, and it's still a strong market. But is there space to support the 30 and 35 makes that are in there? And I think we'll see some culling happen. And part of it will be in response to the fact that you pick up a newspaper or you pick up any story, and the constant litany is sedans are dead. I don't really agree, but I don't think they're totally dead, but they're certainly hurting. The other thing is that sedans give you an opportunity to express your brand in a better way when it comes to dynamics, when it comes to design, when it comes to deciding what the purest expression of your brand is. It's much easier to do in a sedan or a coupe or in a sports car, excepting somebody like GMC, which is certainly a truck brand, but when you get into a mixed brand, I think that for some brands, because of that, it's going to remain an important part of their market. It may not be an important part of every brand's portfolio, but it still will be important in the market.
Yeah, and it goes back to just how important branding is. Mm-hmm. I mean, in the SUV world, everything's a five-door box. And so you have to figure out how do you continue to differentiate that brand. The Jaguar we just did obviously is doing it by building sports cars and going into racing, even heavier into racing with two E-Series now. That's how they build their brand. Mm-hmm. And for Honda, obviously, the branding that they've gotten from the Civic Si and the Type R, these affordable hot hatch things is huge to bringing folks into their lineup. So yeah, I think you're right, Steph. I mean, it's the branding just drives so much of this industry because they got to differentiate.
And a successful brand has a lot behind it. It has personality behind it. It has core values behind it. It's something that you can recognize.
Yeah.
And some of these do it really well.
Okay, final thought here from Mike. Picking up on what we were talking about, electric cars, he says Europe's going to have to adopt plans to develop an infrastructure to provide all the electricity to power tens of thousands of new EVs that'll be on sale in just a few years. And he says countries like Germany are saying they are not going to go nuclear. So he suggests the only other option is wind. One can imagine a big boom in wind turbines in Europe, especially floating wind turbine farms.
Yeah, good luck.
Isn't that a good point? I mean,
If
all you're going to do is generate electricity with coal, electric cars are not much of a step forward from an emission standpoint. And if you're not going to go nuclear, and if you don't have enough hydropower, what are you going to do?
It's a problem. And the other problem is everybody wants, if you go to a point where there's a substantial amount of electric vehicles, then electricity is still a commodity. just like gasoline is. And the idea that an electric car is cheaper to operate than a gasoline car could be flipped on its head.
Right. No, I mean, right, utility emissions dwarf transportation emissions. Right now, they're about 30% versus 10% for transportation. But here's my prediction. Just as these faddish governments decided diesel was the answer 20 years ago, now they don't like the particulates from diesel. In 20 years, they're not going to like the manufacturing tail that comes out of manufacturing lithium-ion batteries. I mean, not only is all of that energy come from South America and Australia, but the mining process can be very ugly. So
they're
I'm predicting
like,
in 20 years the politicians are not going to like batteries either.
The batteries. They're yeah. not going to like the intense amount of energy it takes to make the batteries.
Yeah.
And they're going to hate even more the fact that nobody knows how to recycle lithium-ion batteries in volume.
That's right. Right.
And so if they're just going to end up in the landfill, you're right, Henry, in another 20 years, they're going to go, these stupid electric cars are...
We're going to hate them.
They're bad for the
environment. You've got to get rid of the batteries.
And yeah. sticking all your, or the majority of your eggs in one basket doesn't tend to work very well. I mean, we've just got watching, you know, the hurricanes ravaging the Caribbean and what Puerto Rico has no electricity.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, so imagine yeah. if they now, also only had electric vehicles.
Right, right, right. But, you know, when the electricity's out, you can't pump the gas at the gas
That's
pumps
true.
Either.
That's
so
true.
Now maybe you get a power generator. And
But you still need fuel for that. So, yeah.
You need fuel for that, too. So this stupid planet.
Everything comes out of the ground in the end.
Everything's coming apart.
You've got to get it out of the ground.
The fact is that we want energy. And we need energy, and we're using it for a bunch of different things. And when, whether it's electricity or gasoline, when we talk about it, we don't always remember that that's functionally what we want. We need energy in order to make things work.
That's the first world.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, we got to wrap it up, guys, but this has been terrific.
It's been great.
Stephanie Brinley from IHS Market, great to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me here.
Henry Payne, the car critic for the Detroit News. Great having you here again.
Thank you, John.
And, of course, I always want to thank all of you for having tuned in.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems. And by Hyundai, better drives us.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday afternoons. Get your daily fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.